Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Lone Wolf, Big Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Out. Andrew on the board. We have S&P futures. Well, we'll get those in a second. We have a big down day yesterday, and we had a big drop in the bitcoins and the cryptocurrencies that I think caused a lot of it. But all the averages were down huge. And I'll find out exactly where here in a second. Right now we got the S&P's down 15, NASDAQ down 96. Dow was actually up 10. As for the carnage yesterday, it was about as bad as it gets. The my machine is a little gagging here because I got so much stuff on here. We were down a bunch. We were down like 4-something in the NASDAQ. Do we have Professor Kevin? We are down 46 in the NASDAQ. We are down 80 in the S&Ps. So, we were not good yesterday. And a lot of it had to do with there was some kind of a hack in one of the exchanges, the crypto exchanges affecting the Ether. So Ether was down over 12%, which sent Bitcoin at one point was under 100,000, which it was 126 not that long ago. So that's a pretty big hit. So I don't know that much about it's actually Kevin. I'm sorry I'm talking too much here, but one of the guys in the I mentioned last week that the bartender at my local place and last week was telling me he wanted to put $1,000 into one of his new coins, and I said, well, you know, could I do it for him? And I said, no, we don't really do that. I said, but you know, be careful. These things, you don't even know what it is, kind of thing. So last night I said, you know, these things were down yesterday. And he said, well, I was in here talking to a couple of like real traders. Okay, so that wasn't me, I guess. said, well, all they do is tell me put it in there and don't look at it for 10 years and like you'll be rich. And I go, okay, well, whatever. And of course, he found another guy in the place telling him, oh, yeah, just put it in there, whatever it is. Those things are going to the moon. It's pretty scary, isn't it?
What's the expression? What goes up must come down?
Well, yeah. And, I did a lot of currency work when I was in college or in grad school, and all the currency papers are that at some point every currency will drop to the level of its intrinsic value. Now that gets a little more complicated when you have these fiat currencies, and you know, kind of what is the value? The value is kind of the scarcity because they're backed by a government. They're not really pushed to gold or anything like that. But when you start talking about something totally different as a currency when there's literally nothing behind it other than a computer program, it's, you know, I wish I'd have bought Bitcoin at $10,000. I mean, no question about that. But when it comes right down to it, and you start doing a lot of things with it. Now, the concerns I have with it is if you had a thousand, there's something called street name in stock. In other words, nobody really has stock on their own anymore. I mean, pieces of paper. I mean, some people probably do, but it's been frowned on for decades. So if you have stock, it's probably going to be in an account at Merrill Lynch, or if it's at PTI, it's either Interactive Brokers or at RBC. And the stock is really, even though it's yours, it's held in what they call street name. And the companies have an inventory, and you have your sheets, and you have everything that you have there. And if somebody wanted to short the stock, they can short it. They can take that stock to the bank and pledge it. Prevaricate or something is the term. And they can get money from a bank, and it's based on 50% margin and all that other kind of stuff. So everybody kind of knows where all this stuff is. Now, when you start monkeying around with this in the crypto world where everybody has allegedly a password to get into the thing. I don't have any idea, Kevin, what the equivalency of street name is. I mean, I sort of get it that if you have some Bitcoin and you have your password, that's the system that we've had explained to us a few times on the show. Is that how all the exchanges get involved and end up, you have to give them your password so they can prevaricate your Bitcoin? I mean, I don't know how it works. So,
I don't know a lot about it. I am not a cryptocurrency expert. I own a very little, just because, you know, and I'm talking little like in terms of a few hundred dollars, just because I wanted to see how it works. And I really don't do anything with it, so I'm probably not the guy to be asking about it in general. But what you do is you have a wallet, basically, where you park your funds. That's what you have to remember. But to trade it, you trade out of your wallet.
But how do you give it to an exchange or to Coinbase to lend it to somebody else or something?
To lend it to somebody else, don't know. So I said, then you're getting out of my expertise.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how that all works, because I don't think a bank's going to take that. How can the bank get possession of it if they need it?
Well, yeah. What you would have to do is you would have to turn it into dollars. You'd have to liquidate your wallet. You have to turn it into dollars if you want a bank to do anything with it.
All right. Well, your buddies last night came back. I gave up on them when they were down 20. The Bulls.
Yeah, I was long asleep by the time they came back. They were actually down as many as 24, and they came back and won the game.
Wow.
Which is
the game. Well, today we're going to have a
we actually do have Mark on.
Yeah, I mean, just to set it up, Dr. Mark, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. I've been interested listening to this conversation because I know nothing about that stuff.
Well, let's put it this way. A lot of people have made a lot of money in there that don't know anything about it either, which is fine.
I'd accept that.
Yeah. The theme of why, we'd like to talk to Dr. Mark anyway, but Dr. Mark Johnson, psychologist, lives in, you're still in Hanover, right?
No, I'm in Vermont. I've been in Vermont now for a while.
So it's like right across the river or what?
I moved to Vermont in, 96, but my practice stayed just across the river from Hanover in Vermont. There's, you know, Hanover's right at the New Hampshire-Vermont border.
Okay.
Anyway, it's like the twin states, so it's the Upper Valley, it's all the same place. Anyway, but I'm happy for this invite to talk about veterans' mental health.
It started with Di talking about Diane Kelly, who does a lot of work for Fisher House and does a lot of volunteering at the veterans home here in Maywood, the Hines facility. And she goes around and Mark on Sunday mornings and gives out communion at the Mass, and then goes and gives it to guys that don't, you know, that can't make it to Mass, and it talks to them and has a pretty good idea of what's going on. And she was talking about the amount of suicides and how they're really not set up to do an awful lot of mental health work, and it seems like that's becoming more and more of an issue. And she even said that their new Fisher House is up at Great Lakes. This is kind of a separate subject, but that one's set up to do not only veterans, but for people that are in training and people that are active duty. And the mental health problems there is dramatic. People going through basic training or actually being out on, you know, that's where they'll bring guys from active duty that have problems, that are either injured or have. So Kenny Pulcheri, just out of the blue, he's on our Tuesday guy. And what's the name of his project, Kevin? It's Head Smart, Head Something?
Yeah, I heard it yesterday and I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't know. I had a website up yesterday, and of course, the Headstrong. Headstrong is the name of it. And they raised $4 million the other night at some big thing in New York for this Headstrong project. And what they do, Mark, is they're obviously somehow affiliated with the veterans, but they're not part of any program. They do it themselves, and the people that need help, either at home or maybe even in one of the hospitals, they have, didn't he say, Kevin, it's the budget is like $9,000 a person, and they visit, was it every week or two to start out, and then it's every month, and they think it's a 9-month project they put in for every person. And they visit, and I didn't ask if there's any drugs involved or whatever. I mean, obviously, if there's something you need it. So I just was, I know you've done a lot of work in this area. It's just a background. Are people from every war, is it the same disease? Is it different? How much of it is coming home and there's no family? How much of it is no support? How much of you lost a leg? Or is it all, everybody's totally different?
Yeah, but, and that's actually a great question. I mean, the VA has actually put mental health treatment on the map in the United States. So let me just, this as a quick background, right? Post-World War II, the VA expanded immensely and trained a lot of psychologists and mental health people, then treating what they were calling combat fatigue, which had been shell shock in World War I, et cetera. But that's, you know, that's just general background. The thing I, you know, pulled up in advance for this talk was, or at least chat with you guys, is just a quick summary and comparison of veterans to the general population in terms of the prevalence of psychiatric diagnoses or problems. Right.
And Mark, before you get into that, could you share with the listeners just a little about your background as, you know, not just your background for as a psychologist, but also your background, your military background.
Thanks, Kevin. I forgot that Dr. Mark is also a veteran.
I'm a vet, so there's that. After our glorious career at Notre Dame, I joined the U.S. Army as a neuropsychiatric technician. There's a fancy euphemism for psych orderly, and went to work on the inpatient service at Brooke Army Medical Center in Fort Sam Houston, Texas. San Antonio, Texas. So I did that for 3 years. So I was working with mostly people the war had ended in April of 75. This was 76 to 79. So we're seeing the fallout. We're seeing the early stuff that really eventually turned into all the diagnostic stuff around PTSD. PTSD wasn't even a thing then. In 1980, the American Psychiatric Association put it in the diagnostic and statistical manual. So it became, you know, a diagnostic entity. And since then, it's just exploded. I mean,
same thing as battle fatigue back in World War II?
Well, it's yes and no, Tom. It's a good question, because there's been really interesting studies that show differential rates for psychiatric problems. What Vietnam versus the Gulf Wars versus Afghan, you know, in Iraq, it's not the same thing. And it doesn't affect people the same way. And you just, as a psychologist, you're just a person, it's context driven, right? I mean, those wars had different meanings to the people involved. And were fought different ways with different sorts of landscapes and weaponry and occupations and et cetera. So it's all that affects people's psychology. But those are all really good questions. I went from there to my doctorate. I got my master's while I was in, got my doctorate at Penn State afterwards, then went to Dartmouth as an intern and postdoc and all that, and I've been in private practice since 86. But in my training cycle at Dartmouth, I went through the VA in White River, which was the point of the spear for PTSD treatment in the world at the time. But that's broadly expanded. But
is that a veterans hospital of a sort?
Yeah, it's a veterans hospital right here. It serves the state of Vermont and half of New Hampshire because of its proximity, and it had people who were really interested in what was happening to these guys, and these are almost exclusively Vietnam vets, although every now and then we'd get World War II or Korean vets in there because they'd fit the criterion, but they never had access treatment. And there's a whole other backstory to the whole thing, which is the stigmatization of being diagnosed with a, quote, mental illness and then having to see a psychiatrist or psychologist for help because it's still in the air, especially for men.
Well, that was brutal back then. I mean, look what happened to you.
No, you didn't talk out of school about it. You know, people would leave meetings if you brought it up. I mean, so it was, you know, it was really loaded. It's changing, but it's still a factor, so it's still a thing. But let me just quickly give you, this is an overview. I mean, it's a 100-mile-an-hour overview. But the suicide rate among vets is almost double the general population. The depression rate is four times as high. The anxiety rate's at least double, if not triple. PTSD is, and the worst is a fivefold increase. And alcohol use disorder is roughly double. I mean, those are all, I mean, that clusters together around how people often come out of war experience or trauma. I mean, it's
does
really...
Does it matter whether somebody was physically injured or not, or has someone, yes, a family to, yeah, drop home to, or, I mean, well, what has that all affect in there?
Yeah, I mean, there's the kind of categories, if you will. I mean, there's what they call operational trauma, which is exposure to violence, death, or threat via deployment. That can, you know, result in a number of things. The one that's really when people pay a lot more attention to now is traumatic brain injury. And there's a lot of those from just being in the field, right? Just being, you know, bombs going off around you. You're riding around in a truck that's banging all over the place. I mean, you can get a brain injury. I mean, talk to football players, right? I mean, there's all kinds of ways TBIs happen. But the one that's, to me, is really is curious in this, it came in about 2010. They started to study what they were calling moral injury, which is a real shift away from a medical model approach to, you know, what happened to your brain, et cetera. And that, just quick, a definition there, they called moral injury a psychological distress from actions or experiences that violated your moral or ethical code. Unlike PTSD, it is less about fear, because PTSD is really a phobic fear response, like you jump down on the ground when you hear a car backfire, that kind of thing. This moral injury has to do more with guilt and shame and the loss of meaning. And that phrase really is resonant for people who do stress research about war. The loss of meaning question is center. It's right in the middle of it. People who were studying the Israeli wars back in the 60s picked up on this. They called it a sense of coherence. The people lost it, like, why am I here? What are we doing here? What's this all about? I mean, why am I in the middle of this? Why am I killing people? Why are people shooting at me? It you know, that's a real thing for soldiers, especially.
Was Jimmy Stewart an example of that?
Huh, that's a good question.
Because his whole life changed when they bombed the wrong city.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's an example of what you're talking about?
Yep. Yeah, I think so. And it gives you, I mean, we talked about barriers to care and that stigma. The other thing, though, that is really true for the military types is what they call transition stress, like leaving your service branch or your unit, which is often where your loyalty is. And now you're back home and there's no camaraderie, there's no identity, there's no structure. That's a very stressful circumstance.
And that's coincident, Mark, to societal changes about people living, being more isolated, being, you know, living more of their lives online, which has its, you know, has its interactions, but it has its a great detachment to it.
Absolutely, Kevin. I mean, there's an alienation syndrome talked about around people who have, you know, 4,000 friends on Facebook, but they haven't been out of their house to see anybody. That kind of thing.
We throw that social construct coming out of the military into that environment.
And, oh yeah, it's like gasoline. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, and they feel, you know, the quick jargon is other. They feel like unless you were in there, maybe the guy right up the street from me is like this. He served in Iraq and Afghanistan, 4 deployments, and he doesn't like to go to the store, because he feels people just don't get what's going on in his head, and I'm sure he's right. Right? He feels so not in this culture, so not a part of the world that he's occupying. And it's, you know, look, what, you know, what follows is now he's a meth addict. Right? Great.
Well, Mark, does it help that nobody here, especially in cities and small towns, I think people are more into people come back and forth, in, you know, to Afghanistan for sure. Cities, nobody knows anybody who's in the army. Nobody cares. Is that part of it? Part of the cause?
It's, you know, we went through this in our own upbringing, right? Because our fathers fought in World War II.
Yeah.
Right? And they were proud of it, even though, at least in my experience, I think you guys would echo this. My uncles and father, when you'd ask them about the war, it's like, no. They didn't want to talk. It wasn't like, oh, yeah, I killed a bunch of people. No.
Well, they drank excessively in groups when they got back.
Yeah.
Huge.
But these folks kind of blend in. I mean, there's a way in which you can see some of them holding on to that identity. They'll wear khakis around, or they're, you know, they've got bumper stickers on their, you know, 101st Airborne on their car, whatever. It's not like there's no pride there. But I think it's tough. I mean, those were unpopular wars. Right, very unpopular. And we saw what happened with the Vietnam vets. I mean, they got
spit on coming home.
Well, my brother-in-law got spit on.
Yeah.
He fought with Ollie North in Vietnam, and he was hardcore about that. He really was bitter about that. So yeah, I mean, but there's a couple of things I just draw out quickly because of what's changing. I mean, that there's that piece about the moral thing, but the thing that's really changed, I think, in a good way for vets and treatment, is that there's been a real serious effort to integrate primary care with mental health service delivery. That was not the case before. You could see your doc, and your doc wouldn't ask you about sleep and about mood and about, you know, your just your general sense of yourself. So because that's available now, I mean, because docs in the VA system at least are expected to do that, they have what they call a soft handoff now to somebody. And it's interesting the breadth of it now. You can get handed off to a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker or a chaplain or a group or just someone, you know, and who was maybe in your unit who might be willing to talk to you. So just there's attempts to at least end that isolation, which seems to have paid off. I mean, there's good stuff.
I think you are... You're talking a little bit about the place by you. What Diane's talking about here is every one of these places sort of has a specialty. Well, the one here is prosthetics, cancer treatment, and those kinds of things. And she says they're just trying to ramp up the psychological part. They're way behind on that here.
Well, it's true. I think it's all over the country, Tom. One of the things that's also another change that you could thank technology for is telemedicine now. I mean, especially where I live, it's a rural area. And many of these guys either wouldn't come to the VA or couldn't, and if they have a phone or if they have a computer, most people will have one of those two. They can have appointments via Zoom, and do their thing with somebody, and that's cut down on people, you know, just blowing off appointments and not showing up. But there's an anonymity to it that I think people value. Like, they don't have to go to the parking lot. They don't have to sit in a waiting room. They don't have to see anybody. They just see their provider and then, you know, turn the thing off and go about their business. So there's attempts at improving access. But the rates are, you know, the suicide rates are actually tipping. They fell for about 10% between 2018 and 22. It was the biggest drop in 20 years. So there's, you know, around the edges, there's some evidence that things that trying to reach out to vets and paying attention to particularly depression. I mean, the common cold in my field is depression and anxiety. So, I mean, if anyone who comes to see me is one of those two or both.
When Kenny's group tries to put some sort of a budget on this where they're talking about.
Yeah,
9,000 a person. And Kevin, did he say the first beginning is they saw a guy once a week or once every 2 weeks, and then it went to every month, and they expected to have progress? Well, they were looking at a 9-month program. I mean, I know you have to do something like that. I mean, you have to have some kind of idea what you're going to spend per person. But is that can people be pigeonholed into that? I mean, I would think maybe a few people take a couple of visits, a few people never.
Another really good question. I mean, the two treatments that have been shown, at least with PTSD, to do be the most efficacious. One's what they call prolonged exposure therapy, where you kind of give people a gradual, safe, what they call it, systematic desensitization, where you start to get exposed to the things that you're most afraid of in a kind of hierarchical manner, but you're not doing that in two sessions, right? And it's very idiosyncratic. I've had people who, you know, we're going through that protocol, they're done in a month. Great. You know, all they had to do is see that they could get back in the car after the car accident and they can drive again. Great. Other people, 2 years in, they don't want to go to the parking lot. So it's those. It's really tough to. I mean, capitating mental health treatment around number of sets. I get the math around insurance companies, or you know, it costs more money. Treatment costs money. So, but I think we almost have to live with. We're looking to try to do more, you know, efficient treatment. People are. So it's no goal to keep people in therapy, but you know, it's really individualistic.
Who are the guys that if all of a sudden, you know, Kenny's group wanted to have something here, you know, and they're not really tied up with the VA hospital, but if they wanted to have a presence at either Great Lakes or at Hines, are these volunteer people from private practice? Are they people hired by them? Are they people on the VA? I mean, who are these guys, I guess, is the question.
I'm ignorant, Tom. I don't know. I wouldn't be sure, but I, you know, you hope they're qualified. I mean, the other sort of treatment option is a cognitive restructuring program. And that, again, that's more for the folks who struggle with the moral stuff, like when you kind of challenge them about guilt and shame and their conflict around responsibility for, you know, who caused what. I mean, that protocol, if you will, you can train a sharp high school kid to deliver that. And I'll get shot by people who think this all has to be done by the mental health professionals. I just think you have to be someone who's willing to show up and listen, and who's capable of kind of framing things so someone can think there's another way to see this. And I don't think you have to have a master's degree or a PhD or MD to do that. But you have to have somebody who shows up. A lot of what the vets I've seen would say is the people that matter to them are the ones that do that. They show up.
Well, what's the mix between people that are physically, I won't say perfectly fine, but physically fine, and people that have lost a leg and an arm? I mean, what is it? There's got to be.
That's another layer of loss. I mean, it's hard. I mean, there's always going to be a grieving element in that. There's, at least in my experience, folks with physical injuries like that, they really have to struggle. There's this essential tension between gratitude and bitterness, right? They're grateful they're alive. They know buddies who didn't make it. They know people who had it worse than them, and they're pissed off that they lost, you know, a limb or an eye or, you know, something that really, you know, that you can't replace. So, I mean, it's really tough attitudinally. The ones who get through that the best are much more inclined to think, well, how can I maximize what I can do, want to do with what I've got, rather than be focused on what I lost.
Well, you see, some dudes running on a lakefront with two metal legs, they obviously have an attitude that is something you can't even believe. And then there's obviously others that aren't like that. I mean,
this goes back to PTSD. There's plenty of research now that the people who develop PTSD likely had a preset or even pre-existing conditions that made them prone to that. Because, you know, and I saw this with my brother-in-law who was in everybody in his platoon in Vietnam had a Purple Heart, right? And he came out of it, he drank too much, but he did not have PTSD in the traditional sense. And his attitude going in was, if you want to fight, we'll fight. I mean, that was his deal. I'm just here to fight, and my country told me to fight, so I'm fighting.
What do you do with guys like, I don't know if you listened at all on Tuesday, but Professor Hal was a, nuclear reactor dude on a cruiser. And he talks about 8 weeks in the Persian Gulf with a water temperature was 93 degrees. You never got out of the thing, and it was 140 the whole time. And you could have problems from that just without even shooting anybody, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to, you know, it's not a surprise. Like about half, get this, in the Iraq, Afghanistan, the aftermath of that, roughly half of those guys get diagnosed with PTSD. Think of that.
Wow.
I mean, that's astonishing from a mental health perspective.
This is Iraq 2, I assume, not Iraq 1.
Yeah.
Iraq 1, I would guess, was probably, I don't want to lob a political question here, but I guess I will. I mean, I think the people in what's going on in Gaza?
Well, that one, if there's not, I mean, I would bet 70-80% of those folks are going to come back with big trouble.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. The government can say everything was justified, but if you just lobbed one at a hospital and you know there were 10 women inside, I think you got a problem living with yourself.
Oh, I would think that's kind of defining the moral suffering problem there. I mean, it's hard not to think those people have major trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it's individual. If you think, you know, it's you watch the stuff in you know, you watch 12 O'Clock High, right? And you're always shooting another guy down who's trying to shoot you. So yeah. I guess morally you can sort of deal with that, but once it gets beyond that, I'd have trouble with it.
Oh yeah. I just pulled this table up, Tom, for PTSD rates by war. Vietnam era, I'll just give you the highest numbers, was 30%, Gulf 12%, Iran, Afghanistan 20%. So it's, you know, there is a difference. And it's significant, too. Female veterans have it worse than male veterans in terms of those diagnoses. You know, you could argue they're more permeable to some of the emotional reaction to it. But
how does it add? But it has to add somehow. What Diane always talks about is the amount of cancer rates coming out of Vietnam. You know, this is so bizarre, Mark. This is, and I'm wandering off here, I know, which I do all the time, but I tried, she said that on the air one day, and I tried to find it. I couldn't find it. You probably can as a doctor. So, of course, out pops Korea. If you want to get good information sometimes, you got to go overseas. They claim that the cancer rate among regular South Koreans is 24%, and the South Koreans that helped us out in Vietnam, I guess there were a bunch that did, right, that actually fought with us in Vietnam, it's almost 30. So that's a big difference, isn't it? I mean, 6%?
A huge difference. I mean, one of the things that's, you know, it's been coming since about 80 is the notion that broadly stress, I mean, we know stress affects, you know, your adrenaline system, fight or flight system. Everyone's heard that one. What's clearer than ever now is that it affects your immune system, and so your compromised immune system and cancer go together. So it's not a big surprise in a certain way that there's going to be higher cancer rates in people who undergo any trauma, and certainly war would fit it. I mean, we've got, you know, there's been stuff coming back with, you know, the fire pit stuff. I mean, there's lots of cases.
Yeah, what's that all about? We have a listener that wrote me an email about that. Now she knows a guy in Denver, an online friend of hers, and she said you guys should talk about this fire pit thing. I didn't know anything about it, but evidently they burned all this crap and people were bivouacked next to the stuff and all these chemicals, and some of these guys are a mess, evidently, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, and it's like, you know, you can pick your war. Agent Orange for the Vietnam vets, you know, burn pits in both the Gulf War and Afghanistan. In the key, you wouldn't be surprised about this, the key exposures for cancer in Korean World War II, one of them, of course, is radiation, but the other one is tobacco.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because you look at any World War II era footage or movie or depiction of that time, everybody's smoking.
Well, they gave it to you for free.
The cigarettes arrived in the care packages.
Oh, well, yeah. Get this, Kevin. When I was on, this is 1976, so I'm on an inpatient unit in San Antonio, and stocked in the nurse's cabinet in the nurse's station were Marlboro cigarettes, which we handed out liberally to reward good behavior on the unit.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, Mark, I've always been a little curious, as you know, but since I've been doing the show, it's become almost a phobia. We went to a funeral in Manteno. Not Manteno, the other way. Out northwest. I don't think of the name of the town. It's just past Huntley.
Far away in Illinois.
So we're waiting for the body to show up in the cemetery, right? Because we didn't go to the funeral home. It was kind of weird. So I'm just walking around looking at the gravestones, like the knucklehead I am. And virtually every one of these guys has got a World War II star on it, right?
Right.
And I'm looking at the deaths, 52, 56, 58, 60. Once in a while you'd see a guy 70.
Oh, yeah.
But everybody was, and then, you know, the Korean guys are there, and they may be a year or two longer, but I'm thinking these guys must have all smoked like fiends, came back, did the same thing, drank too much, and virtually nobody made it to 65.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, you're honest. I mean, you could pull it up. If you have chat or something, pull up, just ask about cancer rates, differential cancer rates for veterans by different campaigns. You'll get it. I mean, there's, but it's, some of that research is more solid than others. I mean, it's, you know, causality, Kevin would know this really well, the science of that's, I mean, there's plenty of correlational data, but causal stuff, it gets fuzzier. But there's no question that there's differences. And some of them are generational differences. Some of them have to do with the, what they're exposed to in the combat or circumstances that they were in. But it, you know, just adds to the mix for vets.
Does it matter which branch of the service you were in? Is there a difference there?
I think Army and Marines take it harder than the Air Force and the Navy, yeah. Because the ground-based guys. Now, I worked with a bunch of Navy vets, though, too, who, Navy guys on carriers, they're exposed to all kinds of shit.
Well, I can imagine, yeah. What you know, the program, I mean, this stuff that Kenny's doing, it sounds to me like they're trying really hard and raising dough. How much of this private, public? I mean, you've kind of been involved in both. You've worked on the vet side and on the private side helping. What's the optimal marriage there?
You know, that's a good question too. I think it's hard in either environment to get coordinated care. I'll say this: I think the Veterans Administration is really. I mean, when they started, it's actually one of my friends in here at Dartmouth is a. Now retired, but was a high up muckety muck in the VA in Washington, and he was a very unusual dude. He was a board certified internist, family practitioner doc who came into the Dartmouth. He did a second residency in psychiatry and got board certified in that. So he's a double boarded doc who's really thinks about people's general health and mental health simultaneously. The VA has done a way better job than the civilian population docs of integrating those kinds of services. So I think the civilian side could benefit from opening up to, you know, the VA. It's usually we're going the other way, like the VA is behind the times, they're backwards, they don't know what they're doing. That's not true in this case. So, I mean...
Well, I have to ask the question, is that because you're at the place that was specialized in that? I mean, if you go in the Heinz here, would you find the same thing if you went to the...
That's a good question, too. I mean, Andy is, my friend's name is Andy. He set up kind of centers for that approach around the country. Some were, you know, city-based, some were rural-based, but it's not fair to say it's penetrated the whole country. So you're right. It's not everywhere, but it's certainly, I mean, conceptually, they're on board with it. Some of it is manpower. It's more, you know, it's a little more expensive because you need more personnel. You also need to communicate better. This is a common complaint, and certainly in my civilian practice, people that their doctor specialist types don't communicate with each other.
I'm dealing with that now. You know, that's my job now is to make sure that they're all, you know, dealing with some health issues, and you know, there's three different doctors and. They aren't on the same page, even though they all have access to the same information. And so I'm constantly yelling at them, I want you guys to collaborate, damn it.
Amen, Kevin. I often with my private patients who are going through anything like that, one of the first things I'll say to them is, look, you got to understand now, you must be your own advocate. Like, you've got to be the one that says to Dr. A, hey, did you see the test results that Dr. B ordered? Because they're going to affect what we all do. And often the answer is, who, what doctor? Like, they don't even know. It's amazing. So it's.
And so now we take it back and we talk about a veteran who's really, you know, struggling and saying, well, you have to be your own advocate. That's not easy. Yeah.
Well, it isn't. No, it takes both a doggedness, which I would bet you have, Kevin, but you've got to be willing to kind of learn some of the jargon, and you've got to be able to get an audience. You have to be able to get, it's not easy to, you know, texting and emails and all that stuff don't necessarily get it. You need to often at least voice to voice or face to face, even better. And it's complicated because these people have different fiefdoms, different expertise, and guess what? They don't always agree about treatment. So now what, right? And back when I was younger in training, they used to have a case manager person. Someone would be that ombudsman for that, all that information. That person doesn't exist.
Yeah, anymore. Why did they get rid of that? I don't, you know, interesting you guys put up this subject, because tonight we call it a Tooman night. We go to the bar and this guy, Judge Tooman, who was a really head and shoulders kind of judge around here, and everybody liked the guy, and this tough little Irish dude, and he had some really... He did the Jeff Fort case. Remember that, Mark?
I don't know this
Remember
case.
The Jeff Fort, the guy from the Blackstone Rangers? They got all the federal money, and then he ended up being invited to Nixon's inauguration, and then he was in jail the next year. Some bizarre... But anyway, it was machine guns around the courthouse, and he was... But anyway, so... Mm-hmm. But he had no family. His sister lives in California. He gets sick. He goes to the Northwestern. He's there for 10 days. He comes out. Nobody had any idea what they did to him. There was no prognosis. There was no anything. He was just there, running up this big bill. And nobody, I mean, somebody should have been. You know, if you can't do it yourself, somebody's got to be with you. Otherwise, you don't know what they're doing, and they don't tell you. It's crazy.
I did not know that.
It's a actually, you know, I just real quick is one of his biggest appeals cases. It still stands, I think, is somebody in the mob bought off the jury. This reminds you of the case they just had with the rapper, right? Somebody in the mob bought off the jury, and so they tried him again, and they said, "Oh no, you can't do that. It's double jeopardy." So Tooman's ruling at the appeals level, which I think went all the way to the top and survived, was because he bought off the jury. He was never in jeopardy, so it wasn't double jeopardy.
That's a legal fine point.
Well, but why were you in jeopardy if you bought off the jury?
Right. Well, no, I agree. I mean, it's
anyway. But that's the same thing that happened to him. It's happening just what you guys are saying. It's happening especially to older people with no family. They go in the hospital, and no one knows what they do to them.
Yeah, I just think that civilian military pairing is ultimately where we would be most benefited.
Well, did you ever? Well, did anybody ever have an idea that when you were in practice, and I think you probably still do some stuff, to say, hey, Dr. Johnson, how about working a day a week at the Veterans Reserve every 2 weeks, and we'll pay you, and blah, blah, blah. Is there ever anything like that going back and forth?
I haven't been approached with that, but I've thought of it. I mean, I'm still, you know, seeing about, you know, whatever, 20%. I mean, I'm down to about a fifth of what I used to do. I don't have an office practice anymore. I only do stuff on Zoom. I'm consulting in New York and stuff, so I don't do that. I don't have an office-based practice. But the VA...
You lost your couch?
Pardon?
You lost your couch?
Actually, that couch is in my house now.
God. Did you actually hit... You had one at one time?
Oh, sure. But it was not your traditional Freudian lie down and stare at the ceiling. It wasn't that kind of... I could never understand that treatment model. Like, talk to the ceiling and I'll take notes. No.
It looked cool on TV, though.
I think face-to-face is a better way to go.
So you're saying you'd be open to something like that?
Yes, it's a big maybe because those systems are very... what's the right word? That mean they're just sort of regulated in a way that when I trained there, it's the same thing. They have a way of doing business, and you're going to do business their way. That's just, you know, and they have a right. That's their deal, right? They have all kinds of federal mandates. There's certain things that just protocols and things that you have to do things their way.
Are there any drugs that help this, or is that not the right question to ask?
Well, it's a great question. There's plenty of drugs. Right? I mean, anxiety and depression stuff, you know, there's a long history there. PTSD, it seems there's anxiety drugs for like the worst forms of panic attack, yes. But as far as treatment that's going to really change that the kind of structure, the psychological structure of that, it's more in the talk therapy room. The exposure therapy and the cognitive reframing stuff. So that, you know, that the big, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy is sort of the general buzz out in, you know, it's like the most popular form of psychological treatment in the country. And it's a mixed bag to me because the training for that is mixed also. So you can get people who call themselves, you know, qualified CBT therapists because they went to a weekend workshop. And there's people who spent 8-10 years studying it. So it's like there's huge differences in those in the expertise of that. So it's, you know, it's like when you go get a surgeon, right? You don't want the guy who's only done four of them. You want somebody who's done 4,000. So, but you can't get that experience without doing it. So it's, you know, it's complicated. But I don't think drugs to me in this conversation aren't. I mean, they're an adjunct. It used to be the other way. It's funny, when I was in training, they called psychotherapy adjunctive to medical treatment. Now we think the medication's adjunctive to psychological treatment.
Yeah, I mean, you've been every time somebody mentions that, I always quote you and say that, you know, it's not a replacement.
No, it can't be. And that, you know, and I this is my shtick on this. Social stuff, I mean, like the effect of social media, which you guys know more about than me, but having friends, having family, those are much more healthful than we ever knew, right? I mean, they're preventive in certain ways, but they're also sustaining. So vets especially get cut off from families. They get cut off from friends. I mean, it's that. So often what I'm trying to do is get them back into some social arena that they can feel some sense of ownership. They're a member of something.
Like the VFW sort of thing.
Well, yeah, you know, many of them go to the VFW and the, you know, Disabled American Vets because it's $2 beers. And it's like, oh, yikes, you know, we're not looking for another way for you to go find drinking buddies. And that's, they're allowed to drink, it's a free country, but it's a problem. But, it's just a pet peeve of mine. There's this, if you look at fraternal organizations in the United States, in the 1900s, there were hundreds of them, right? Early 1900s. Many men belonged to multiple organizations, right? Now, churches used to be one of the big organizations. That membership is down. There's parts of the country where it's not, but overall, it's way down. You know, and what are our social organizations now?
Right? Kevin and I talk about that when we usually talk about it when a shooting and all these people doing this, these younger kids doing all this stuff. Well, younger kids, I mean, they're over 18, so they're not kids, but it seems like the big, and I have, you know, friends that have kids. They have nothing to do all day, Mark. I mean, it's a problem. Well, they don't play sports. They don't.
They're listening to their, you know, some electronic media thing that really is a problem.
Our dads, you know, pretty much worked all day, bowled twice a week, did something else, did work around it. They had no time for this crap,
right?
Basically. Yeah. Hey, I got a totally off the wall question.
I have one too. So go, Tom.
Well, what happens to the civilian population with this kind of stuff happens in the last few weeks? I don't know why people are showing me pictures of people getting shot, but I was watching the movies and one of my attorney buddies was trying this case, and on the street, of course, it's one of these these clubs, and of course, there's a murder out in front, and of course, he's showing me all the camera work. Well, that's 2 weeks ago. Well, yesterday morning, I don't know if you heard about the mayor of the big city down in Mexico that got shot.
No.
He was anti-gang and all this kind of stuff. Well, evidently, there was this big function, and he was holding his one-year-old, passes the one-year-old off to the wife. Some guy runs up and shoots him in front of, like, all these people. So, of course, I'm watching that thing with a guy in the building here on his cell phone, and I'm watching that, and it was pretty... What happens if the people are standing next to that and see that and you like the guy and what about his family? I mean, is it the same thing or is it different?
It's different, but it's the same. How's that?
Okay.
There's an answer for it. Well, there's plenty of studies that they frame that as vicarious traumatization. You just being a witness is traumatic, and for some people it can be as bad or worse than the family member or whatever, who, you know, not the guy who got shot, of course, but the witnessing trauma is itself psychologically invasive. I mean, it has to do with the psychology of memory and fear. Like when we have something that dramatic happen that we see, the memory storage for that in your brain is, it's like if you look at the MRIs that the people study this stuff, it looks like the 4th of July in the sense that there's, you know, memory centers all over the brain that get activated. So it can be re-triggered or rekindled, if you will, from all kinds of associations. You know, the brain trains you to be ready for bad things. So you could be, you get what they call stimulus generalization. So now you could be afraid of crowds. You could be afraid of cotton candy. You could be afraid of a hot dog. You could be afraid of, you know, the sun at a certain angle. It's just, you know, so there's, for some, and there's all kinds of hard questions people don't have big answers
yet. In the military, you're doing that for 50 days in a row. Go ahead, Kevin. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah. So I want to turn it over to the idea of policy for a minute, and I want to frame it because, you know, when it comes to politics, we have so many contentious issues, but I don't think whether it's veterans or whether it's mental health in general, I think people will have a lot of consensus around being, you know, supporting policy that will advance the cause. Now, when I say that, you know, just to frame it, I'll give you a different example completely outside of that world, and that's, you know, when I teach my IT students, one of my common themes for them is we can teach you technical skills, but, you know, part of what I'm trying to do here is teach you to be a better IT professional. And part of that is, you know, like when it comes to people's data and it comes to privacy and protecting data, that, you have a real duty to do that. And privacy is a huge issue in our country because of the amount of data that's available about every individual and the amount of data that is collected for every individual. And I tell them, you know, nobody talks about this in the political arena. Maybe Rand Paul, and that's about it. Of any prominence. And I said, yet I think this is an absolutely huge issue. And, you know, I say to my students, that's your issue. You know, I'm going to be on the rocking chair on the porch as all this stuff starts to blow up, and or if it hasn't already. So I'm going to be in the rocking chair on the porch watching it. This is your responsibility. You guys need to be pushing your politicians on this. And that's where we go. Where in, you know, specifically in terms of veterans' mental health, but in general as well, where do we need to be pushing the politicians? Because I don't think that this has the same kind of, it's not the hot button thing that we see in so many other political issues. It is one where I think we could make progress if we have focus.
That's a really good question, Kevin, and I intuitively, I think you're right about in the base assumption that I would think the majority of Americans would supporting veterans and support mental health for veterans. And I mean that it's the bridge to the general population that I get caught with. It's like, because there's always going to be dollar signs attached to this, right? So policy stuff's going to have to be comport with the real world about what's affordable, what's not. I mean, to me, there's a telling argument the other way. Like, what's the cost of not doing this? Right? What do we get for that? I mean, this, I get nuts when every time there's a shooting, so-and-so was crazy, that, you know, you must be crazy to do this by definition, but they had no mental health, or they were referred to the school guidance counselor, but there wasn't anybody at the school to help them, whatever. I mean, do we need personnel? I mean, it's a start. I think it's an underserved profession in the sense that the population, the demand for mental health services so outstrips the supply, right? So why not fund training programs to help people get credentialed to be in service there? That'd be one thing I would, you know, from my seat, I think would be valuable. But it needs to be pretty sweeping, Kevin. I think we need, I mean, I've thought this is another, I think we would do well to be talking to school, like grammar school age children about how they manage conflict, how they manage difference, how they manage their feelings. Because I think there's a huge gap there between, I have a sister-in-law who just quit teaching first grade in Florida because kids were throwing chairs at her. And this is not, that's...
We need some school for the parents, for God's sake.
Yeah, well, and you call the parents in and they want to sue you because you're being nice to their kid.
Yeah.
So, it's a big problem. We need affiliation. I mean, there's systems models that talk about... how do you define maturation in a system? In this case, the political system that you're talking about, Kevin. And one of the ways, it's a mouthful as a definition, but I think it applies here. They would say that you can index that based on the group or individual's ability to discriminate and integrate difference, right? So can we deal with difference? Can we, whatever that represents, and I know immediately there's, you know, the DEI people go crazy, but we have differences. It could be, you know, you like hot dogs and I like hamburgers. It doesn't have to be some political thing that everyone gets.
You like dogs, I like cats. You have tattoos. You go to church, I don't go to church. You know, it's all those kinds of things. And you know, I deal with that as a leadership principle, because I not only teach IT, but I teach management and, you know, number of other subjects. And this principle is what I call the so what principle. And that is, you know, it's one thing, you know, explicit bias is bad enough. You know, that's the overt, you know, racism, overt sexism, overt, you know, whatever bigotry you want to put in there. And sorry, I don't have any use for that. And in a management class, they say, sorry, if that's you, you can't work for me. But everybody has a set of implicit biases, just reactions you have to people based on your first impression. And the skill that we need to develop in people, and I preach this nonstop, is you have to start catching yourself in the act. You have to start saying, I have a visceral reaction to people with tattoos. I have a visceral reaction to people who, you know, are clearly not primarily English speakers. I have a reaction. That doesn't mean I say anything or do anything, but you catch yourself in the action of having that reaction, and it's just two simple words. You start to say, so what? I don't care what you are. I care who you are. That's not a DEI concept. The DEI issue is, you know, are we going and saying we're just going to hire people because of what they are?
No, I agree with you, Kevin. I mean, you sound very much like a psychologist here, Kevin, by the way. Good for you, in my view.
Well, we are, guys, we need to we need to reconvene, because obviously we haven't, because a lot of this lobs off into, you talk about people that are kind of outliers. In where I grew up, was basically an Irish Catholic ghetto surrounded by, you know, everybody dealt with the church, and it wasn't, you know, but you would have been really hard to be an outlier, to be somebody who won a chair as a teacher, because the whole neighborhood would have said, what's with your kid? Why is he winging chairs? And, I mean, whoever the teacher was would have gotten support instead of not. I mean, it was. I won't say everybody behaved properly, but you know what I'm talking about. You were able to have 40 kids in a class, and nobody was too big of an idiot, because, you know, it wouldn't have flown, you know, type of thing. And everybody had stuff to do all day. I mean, it was just a different. I'm not saying it was better. You didn't want to be sick back then, for God's sake. But there was a lot of problems all the time. It wasn't like it was Mayberry, but there was a lot of stuff we don't have today, where everybody. What does Lou call it? A moral relativism. I think it's right, so it's okay. Well, okay, that might be fine with you, but not necessarily other people. Let's kick this around, because I think a lot of what you... The bottom line, I think, what you're talking about, Mark, and how much money you put back into this, is we have to get people from the... We're doing stuff for them, and I don't know whether you're sick or... I mean, the reason why you get somebody healthy, really... One is you care about the person, and, you know, that's the way we all are. But the real reason is you get the guy out of the sick bed and get him back to work where he's paying taxes, right? You want somebody to be a productive member of the society, right? And the object is with a lot of the veterans, okay, guys, we're going to get you to the point where you do feel okay to have a job, to go help people do something else. Maybe you can become the psychologist for the next guy. I mean, that's the biggie move-up, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it doesn't have to be the psychologist for the next day. It just, you know, real meaning in your life has a lot to do with service to others, and you know that there is something beyond me. You know, my affiliation can be, what can I do for somebody else? And it doesn't have to be a full-time occupation. Not everybody has that kind of time in their lives. When you're raising a family, this is why, you know, when empty nesters can struggle, I believe, is because you spend so much time doing for the family, and all of a sudden all the kids are gone on their own. Now who do I do for? And so I really think, you know, that's part of the meaning issue, is to get outside of yourself and see, you know, what can you do at least a little bit. And those of us, and Russell's on now too, so, you know, he can chime in on this. It's one of the beauties of being a teacher that I've found, is that you are, you know, helping others with their lives. You're teaching material, but you know, and you get some of this feedback once in a while that is just so incredible and satisfying, and is so enriching, because you know that somebody really appreciates what you did for them.
Dr. Johnson, thank you very much. We're going to reconvene soon, because
I really appreciate this, and I'm impressed with the way this conversation turned. I think you're going in the right direction. I mean, paying attention to others and having an attitude of service, that encouraging that, I think, is ultimately would be cheaper than anybody you could hire.
Well, just so you know, there's the lady Diane I'm talking about, Diane Kelly. She's not Irish. She's a Korean adoptee of an Irish family. And she is deeply religious, and she turned down a job. She's a sommelier, which not many people are. And she turned down, she retired from Southern Beverage. And the first person at the bar when she said she'd retire was the people from, who are the guys with the champagne? Moet. Wanted to give her a big time job, and she said, no, I'm going to volunteer my time for the veterans. And that's what I'm going to do. And now she is in charge of this Fisher House thing. And we're going to make this kind of a continual theme. So, plus, I'd like talking to you anyway, Doctor, as usual.
I'm new too. I like talking to both you guys. So keep up the good work, and I will just let me know when next works, and I'll.
Well, you know who's going to be on Friday to talk about this? Our buddy Mike Murphy.
Michael Francis. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, he's because he, I think, was can give us a more of a blow by blow of what the VA stuff does over in Germany, because I'm sure there was a couple places over there.
He knows a lot about that.
Yeah, he knows a lot about that. So. Thank you very much, and we're going to head off to Russell here. Kevin, thank you. I wish I could have hung in there at the end of the Bulls game, I guess, but I did. I gave up. What can I tell you?
Okay, yeah, you're just such a surrender monkey, Tom.
Well, and then I finally listened on YouTube to the last 4 minutes of the Bears game. Could there be any worse football that was all that exciting, though, wouldn't it?
It was crazy. Yeah, it was crazy. Well, all right, we can talk a little bit.
What did the guys say in the last picture show when they lost?
He likes to talk a little sports, too.
Yeah. What did the guy say in the last picture show? Didn't you guys know how to tackle? It looked like the end of the Bear game.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, bud.
All right.
Thank you both.
Russell, we'll go right to Russell,
and then we'll have a break at the end. Russell, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing just fine. I'm trying to survive becoming an empty nester.
Well, they're fleeing you. They're fleeing you.
If you just saw the look my wife gave me, you would understand why we're still married. She's like, come on.
Well, that means you guys get to go out to dinner.
She can only hear my side of the conversation, so she doesn't know what was
being
talked
about.
My
thing is, why don't you take her to a nice place every night and start running restaurant reviews?
Oh, okay. We'll do. Yeah, we're going to be right on that. And then when next time you see me, I'll have to be wheelbarrowed down to the Loop.
Well, I mean,
I won't fit on the metro. The last thing we need to be doing is going out to eat every night.
Well, you know, all restaurant people aren't big fat souls. I mean. Audrey,
yes,
Audrey could possibly fill in the rest of the book, because she knows where all the lunch and the hot dog joints are, because she's always around during the day, and Audrey's not heavy at all. The two of you guys can get together and write a book, The Professor and Real Estate Guide to Eating on the South Side or something.
But I'm already writing a book with Dr. Adeniak. I can't do that on behavioral finance.
Well, you know, one is not really have anything to do with the other, but
yeah. I'm not taking my wife to a restaurant every night to become a restaurant reviewer.
You're going because you want to take her out.
She even looked shocked.
You want to take her out every night. The other thing is just you're doing something on the side.
Hey, look, I splurged for some little black oven thing that comes with pre-cooked meals that we can pop in there real easily, so we don't really have to cook anymore.
Well, that's romantic.
I think I've done my part, and I'm going to buy a second one when we get a second house down here in Indiana, where I am house shopping right now.
Well, what's really big now? I saw it. How was they? They cost a fortune, but you can get these big circular pizza ovens that are like cast iron and stuff, just like a mini pizza thing from a pizza joint. They cost like $800 or something, but evidently they do a great job on pizza.
Do you want a cast iron pizza oven for the new house?
She's going to say no.
Yeah, it was more of a no and leave me the hell alone for the next hour.
Yes.
What's going on in the world? I came in on the end of that, and I couldn't agree. I know we don't want to stick with that same topic.
Well, no, go right ahead, because it's kind of a theme for the week. And okay.
I'm gonna regale a story along the same lines, and I didn't react the way that I wanted to react when I heard this, but. I was at the library, and I was where we've got some Bloombergs, and I'm working on the Bloomberg. And on the other side are a handful of students looking at what classes they want to take the next semester. And about half of the classes, they said the professors were racist. They were like, no, that guy's racist. He flunked so-and-so. That guy's racist. I mean, they just threw the word around. And part of me wanted to get up and walk around to the other and go, guys... Where why do you think half the professors here are right? What's going on? What have they done? But I risk rewarded that one and decided just not to. What I mean? Yes. I was afraid it would have gone why are you listening to us? Blah, blah, blah. Well, because you're in the library and you're talking in regular voices. But it was just so upsetting to me. And I've heard that term before, but I heard it described so well as I jumped on that term microaggressions, where you just have an automatic, you have these automatic reactions to certain situations. I'm not talking, and it can go beyond, the way other people look, et cetera, or their races, et cetera. But, I assume that they were picking up on some of that. And that's why they were saying that. It wasn't anything that any professor explicitly did.
Well,
and it's become a little bit of a joke in a class that I'm teaching right now. But I have two African Americans that are and they're adults. This is one of my evening MBA classes, and their names are very similar and they look alike, and I have mistaken them for each other. And they give me the hardest time about it. Just a couple of times I've just mistaken them for each other.
That's when you ask them, by the way, do you think all Irish people look alike?
Yeah, it was just like, I forgot to send you that email back. And goes, no, that was, he said, he even knew it because they study, they even work together on their assignments. They're in the same study group. So it becomes, their assignments look exactly the same. You know what I mean?
Well, there's different.
I might be digging myself into a hole.
No, well,
I was going with it was these two people are former professional athletes.
Okay.
And I feel like, and I ran cross country in high school with a bunch of kids that looked exactly like me. That's my athletic endeavors. But my impression is that race just really doesn't exist when you start getting into professional sports. That they really that they just look at each other based on how they perform, how they contribute to the team, et cetera.
It always exists with some people.
And it does exist a little bit, but my feeling is because they had been in that environment, where race just doesn't really come into play, that they may not have even taken it the way that those undergrads would have taken it. Do you see what that's where I was trying to go full circle?
But it's hard to put it.
Was if I mistook one African American undergrad for the other one, they might, because they're a little bit younger and don't have a whole ton of life experience and don't understand that people make mistakes, they're not intentionally doing that. They might automatically hang the racist tag on somebody, whereas the grown ups that have been around for a little while and start to. Have some life experience, but also start to be reasonable and just understand that people make, mistakes, et cetera, and not everything is 100% personal, something that I've been trying to teach my oldest daughter, who you've met a few times.
Yep.
If everybody could take a breath sometimes when somebody makes a small mistake, et cetera, I think that would go a long way.
Well, one mistake, and by the time it gets on social media, it screws your whole life, but... And when you
I make a mistake while I'm lecturing. I'm fired before I walk out of the lecture because of social media.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about racism and things like that. There's all kinds of different levels of how you react to somebody. I was at when Dr. J and I were over in Germany doing lectures, right? We're in Frankfurt, and they had this street thing. Of course, in Germany, it's a lot different than here. They got all the chairs and the gorgeous cobblestone street you could have eaten off the street. You know, it's not like Chicago. And, you know, everybody has glasses for their beer. They wouldn't think of a paper cup, right? And the place is so lily white. Everybody there is white. And all of a sudden, these two gypsies walked by, and I looked at them, and I almost, like, was startled, because not that I have anything against gypsies. I don't. I'm certainly don't have anything against people that have skin is darker than mine, but they look so out of place. It was just, I'm like, almost like, what are you doing here? I mean, here, you walk down the street, you see Chinese people, you see black people, you see white people, you don't even think about it. But there, I'm like, I mean, I wasn't like, it just a sort of, there's a natural reaction from anybody who's anybody who's different from you. And then you have to override that. You have to say, now, if economics becomes part of it, and you say, okay, that person, you know, they took over my neighborhood and I got less for my house or something. If that becomes part of it, becomes part of your bigotry, it becomes part of it. But also, sometimes people give you a message that you don't like, and they give it to you on purpose. If somebody dresses sort of differently, that's one thing. I mean, you know, some people might wear like cardigan sweaters. God, who could that be? I mean,
oh my God!
Yeah, but if all
look,
of a sudden,
look at that creepy old Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, look at that old guy. But if somebody walks down the street in the dead of summer, you know, with their pants by their knees and wearing a hoodie and like where you can't, there's a message there that they're giving to me, and it's not like I'm the one who's you're telling me how different you are, so that. So the messages can go both ways, right? I'm not saying it's a bad message. I don't dislike the person, but
no, absolutely. You know, you can, you know, and I, you know, there maybe certain people dress. You know what? You could equip the equivalent that I try to dress very professionally when I'm teaching certain classes because I, you know, the students are a bunch of professionals.
And if somebody's got a car next to you, it's totally darkened out, and the thing is 90 gazillion decibels, you can't hear yourself think. He or she is giving, I can't see who it is, and I don't know what color they are, but they're giving me the message, and I don't like the message, but they're giving it to me. They're not, it's not like I'm, you know, I saw that person walking down the street, and I don't like them. They're somewhat telling me, you shouldn't like me, or I don't like you, or something. I mean, there's all kinds of levels to this. But, you know, because I'm a huge follower of Martin Luther King. Don't judge anybody by the color of their skin. And that goes both ways, and that's not popular now. Unfortunately, but
no,
I think everybody is equal, and I whatever. Anyway, hey, what is they're bouncing here today? But this morning and last night, all I heard was how the market was down so much because of AI, which is I think sort of BS. I think it all stemmed from what happened in the crypto space yesterday. This Ether was down 12%.
Well, they're kind of closely related, but you know, Palantir reported their earnings on Monday night, and you know, we got some new information about what's going on in the fintech space. So I don't know how much of that may have bled through. I know before their call, the stock was basically unchanged, and then after their call, and I didn't listen to the call because I you know, as you keep telling me every week, I have to do things to keep my wife happy. So I'm house shopping with her, so I didn't really yesterday, so I didn't really get to. I knew the markets were down, and I knew it was a bit tech heavy. Yeah, you gotta just without trying to automatically place the blame. We all have to realize how overvalued these AI stocks are. And that they're and I get very, very frustrated when I hear people say that there's no similarity between what's going on right now and the dot-com bubble. Because the dot-com bubble, we found the internet, a bunch of people are trying to figure out how to make money with the internet. Everybody's investing in everyone that's trying to make money on the internet, whether it's selling pet food or books or whatever. And, you know, out of those 100, we ended up with 4 or 5 big winners.
Well, I've talked about Palantir having the stock was over 300. Where the hell is it today?
It was 180 something when I looked at it last night when a student asked me about it.
You know, I'll find it. I got it up on my.
It's funny, and that's a company that I honestly hadn't paid any attention to.
Well, they're 187. They're down today. They were over 200.
Yeah, they so, and So, you know, the stock's down about 10% this week.
But like Kenny was on, and he was saying, oh, their revenue doubled, and, you know, I don't understand why the stock's down. And Kenny's much more, he's, to be honest with you, he's better at this than I am, than individual stock stuff. I said, but Kenny, sometimes in my experience, the earnings date causes people, instead of just seeing the stock go up every day in momentum trade, it causes people maybe to actually look at the numbers, and maybe they're shocked. Yeah. I said, I mean, on one hand, you sound terrific. Revenue's doubled. And I sit there and go, all right, revenue is a dollar and a half a share. First of all, I don't think it totally doubled, but now if it doubled to $3, it's still pretty friggin' light for a place that's trading 210. I mean, maybe somebody looked at that and goes for the first time and go, wait a minute, why is this thing trading 210? I mean, just the recognition of it. I mean, how many times do they have to double to where that's legitimate, which isn't to say they can't. They could be sitting on a gold mine, for God's sake. I don't know. But, I mean, but every single stock value like that is what has me nervous.
The thing is, you know, you guys are talking about the sales, but I just know from looking at the numbers. I was on one of the brokers networks talking about their earnings, but I was talking about it from an option standpoint, about how the options only were pricing in a 10% move and the average move was 17, and it ended up not dropping that much, you know, and a lot of the option trades were basically that the stock wouldn't go up, not that the stock was going to go down an awful lot. And so the option traders got that one they did a good job on kind of projecting where the risk was. But when I was trying to read through the numbers and talk about it at the same time, it looked like their costs were going up in line, and that, so they're not like seeing this great margin expansion that I think a lot of folks are expecting when they invest in, you know, something that's supposed to eventually, you know, take off like crazy, which is the whole AI thing, like the internet thing did. So I did the smart thing. I asked ChatGPT how firms involved in AI were going to make money. For going to the source.
What did it say?
It said it basically talked about the equipment people. It didn't talk about like revenues from services and things like that. It talked about people that were selling equipment, you know, like Nvidia and those guys. And then it talked about the efficiencies that are going to come from AI. But it's not the same type of scalable thing like Amazon has, where, you know, companies ship things to Amazon. Amazon marks them up a couple of pennies and then ships them out to us and makes us pay for the shipping. Yeah, I don't think there's some sort of, you know, ultimate, you know, pile of gold, as you put it a little bit earlier, associated with offering AI services. Yeah, you know, I think there are possibilities that'll make some companies more efficient. Larissa and I have been using it more and more in some of the research that we've been doing, not to get answers, but to find good sources. Like I needed to quickly.
But you haven't had to pay for any of it. You haven't had to put a dollar in a meter.
Oh no, I pay $20 a month for it.
For what? What do you pay?
For the professional version of ChatGPT.
Okay, well it's $20. It's not.
It puts me at the front of the line. It does think I could tell a difference when I chose to do that.
Okay.
Plus I asked the basic one to do a couple of things, and it turned me down. It was like, you know, that it. You know, in order to get this, you need to. But still, me paying $20 a month for it is not going to. You know, this is not. You know, some sort of a subscription model can only grow so much, and there's enough competition that if the ChatGPT people came to me and said we're going to jack you from $20 a month to $50 a month, I would just switch over to one of the two or three other ones that are floating around out there. Plus, there's a Microsoft-oriented one that I think we get for free at IU. I haven't dug into that yet, so the one that I pay for, the way that I'm utilizing it is what are the top papers on, you know, this topic, and then going to read those papers.
Well, how does that, you know, how does that thing get into those papers when you can't or I can't?
It can read the, anybody can read the number of citations on a different paper. Okay. You can see that before you dig into the paper.
What I'm saying and, is, and
I know what you're saying, but see, I'm not using it for that anyway, and okay. it doesn't need to do that to know what the top papers are. It can just go say, okay, here are the most cited paper on this heuristic, and that gives me a good starting point, and. You know, it may find a couple of things that I don't necessarily find because of the subscriptions we have at IU, et cetera. But it gives me, I've been using it for a starting point like that. There's some basic public data you can get from it. You can't get it, can't create a stock chart.
I don't think you're,
you have to upload the stock data for it to do a stock chart for you.
Well, here I'm giving a lecture to the guy who knows what the hell he's doing and I don't. The difference. Now in getting information out of the internet for a regular schmuck like me, even though obviously we have all these our financial stuff we pay for, I can't get stuff on anywhere. I'll get a headline from some paper, and all of a sudden, if I don't buy the paper,
it's blocked.
It's so everything's blocked all over the place. Now, what you can get through an IU machine is light years different than what I could get. I'm close.
I mean, I can just go read the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
And Barron's and everything else. So, but that's who I am. But just the way that we've been utilizing ChatGPT is more to, you know, get some direction on where to go with research. I'm working on a drug trial study with a couple of physician MBA students. And we double checked a bunch of things using ChatGPT with respect to, you know, the progression of different drugs being approved, and it just pulled different news stories for us that way. But that was more of an organizational tool, and probably saved us a couple of hours of running around and finding all the headlines on different
even for me, when
seven different stocks over a 3-year period.
Well, I mean, during the show, if I'm basically bitching about some stock being too high, or in my opinion. I used to have to dig in through Yahoo and do the math to get the revenue per share, and now I just ask the thing, and it shaves a minute off my. Now I can do it during the show while I'm talking to somebody. To say it doesn't help, I mean, I'm not going to say that, but the idea
it's not a cure-all for everything. No. That's where I'm going with it. So, you know, what I just described to you, other than charging me $20 a month, which I'm probably, if I was getting frustrated trying to find something, so I just stepped up and paid for it. I could probably, if I go to the people that are guiding us on AI at Indiana right now, I could probably find the same things for free at the university. And then it'd be really interesting to find out what the university is paying the provider for that.
After the break, because we have time. Mm-hmm. Is there any? I was sending you guys. I don't know if you read any of my stuff. The emails yesterday. I'm actually very concerned about this. This crypto stuff and what happened yesterday. Because I tell you what, in the blue collar bar in my neighborhood, every one of these guys is involved in this stuff. And Nancy tells me that she's had people take second mortgages on houses to buy Bitcoin. I mean, I think it. And every time I try and find. Using AI, how much leverage is on this stuff? Is, you know, it comes up with, you know, 30 billion someplace and 40 billion somewhere else. It's two different things. I'll do that in break. I'll find it. But I don't think it's anywhere near. Now, Carl yesterday wrote back. I don't know if you saw it that these exchanges. He goes, if one of these exchanges gets hacked into, I mean, nobody can seem to figure out how. How one of these things makes it into street name? Do you have to give them your password or what? How do you sell it short? How do you get money to loan for Bitcoin? A bank's not going to give it to you. I mean, all the stuff that you and I know like the back of our hand in our industry. And our industry is not perfect, but at least you know if somebody buys 1,000 shares of IBM, at least he puts up half of it. And oh, by the way, he's got a 30% maintenance margin, and it's at a real bank, and it's something that we can at least take a look at. I think. Last I checked, they said the total value of all the cryptos is like $2 trillion. Well, if half of that...
It's actually closer to three now.
Okay, it's been a while.
I think Bitcoin, well, you know, it God knows it changes from day to day, doesn't it? Bitcoin's around two.
But what portions of the world, if all of a sudden we walk in one day and Bitcoin's like $1,000, What does that do to people? What, where? Are there countries of the world that are going under? Are there drug cartels that go under, which I don't really care about? I mean, where's the carnage? Where's the hot? I mean, at least, you know, back when in 2000, you know, when Cisco dropped from 65 to 6, I mean, I kind of knew that, you know, the chairman owned 10% and, you know, this money manager in Akron, Ohio owned like 8%. You sort of have an idea where all this stuff is. I have no... All the stuff that you and I normally know, even though it's not everything.
Like who the big holders are.
Yeah, we don't know anything about this stuff. How much is it?
Anonymity there. I mean, you know that there are certain big holders because you can back into different wallets, et cetera, but you don't know exactly who they're associated with. So you do know if big entities buy and sell. Well, we see an awful lot of that. In fact, I did some work for a crypto firm over the weekend where they've got a tool that tells you when they're big, when money shifts from one wallet to another in size, you know, kind of like a block trading thing. I'm going to step in an elevator. If I die on you, just keep talking.
Well, we're going to go on a break. So when you get out, we'll... How about that? SP Futures down a buck, NASDAQ Futures down 16, so we're rallying back here. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right
now, right now. Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 2, NASDAQ Futures down 23. We have the Dow Futures up 6. Let's see, what do we have moving around here today? We've got Amgen up 580. We've got Micron up 577. Micron's managed to weather the storm here pretty good. Palantir, the one we were talking about, is... what the hell is that one? Well, I'll find that in a second. What else? Palantir is down 263. It's 188. It was over 200 before all this started, but they were part of the reason why we were down yesterday over in Europe. And the DAX down 82.3%. FTSE up 15.1%. CAC around down 4. Call that flat. So not much going on over there. We're in Asia. See if these guys... Well, Nikkei's down 1,200. Ouch. That's 2.5%. Again, this is AI valuation concerns. They're also... I think these guys are all involved in this crypto as well. Hang Seng down 16. That's flat. Shanghai up 9. So it's a, Japan is the main one that's down over there. This is a way of review. Yesterday, S&P was down 80. NASDAQ was down 486. That's over 2%. That's a very rare move. Oil down 38 cents, right down to 60.18 again. It's like hovering between 59.5 and 60.5 here for some reason. Brent down 35 cents, 64.09. Gold, which took it on the chin yesterday, is up 24 bucks today, 39.85, trying to get back to 4,000. But it's been dragging lately. Silver up 27 cents, 47.56. Part of this is, has to do with the dollar's been so damn strong. We got the, I got the euro down to 114.81. It was over 117 beginning of last month. That's a 2.5% move. That's a lot. British pound 130. It was 135. We're gonna get Russell's opinion on that as well. Crypto, and this was a part of the problem yesterday. Bitcoin traded under 100,000. It's up 1,800 a day at 102. Ether, which was down 12%, is back up 4%. 33.28. There was some kind of hack at one of the exchanges that affected the Ether product, and I'm not the guy that says can tell you which one of these are different. But anyway, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Bulls, I guess, with a last-minute comeback.
Yep, they got it. It is 7:36 here in Chicago, Wednesday, November 5th. And yep, just a little bit of sports here. Sorry, of course, right as we're going here, my page manages to freeze on me here.
Hate it when that happens.
Let's see.
Well, yep. Look, I'll help you with the weather. It looks like it's cloudy out.
Yeah, it is cloudy, but it's going to be a little warm, and I finally got the Bulls thing here. Yep, it is. The Bulls won against the 76ers, 113-111. For Chicago weather, it is going to be 52 degrees right now. We're going to have a high of 61. It's going to be sunny and partly cloudy with increasing winds throughout the day. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 62 degrees. They're going to have very warm skies with brilliant sunshine, a high of 89. And finally, for Chicago traffic, just one major accident to report. That's on the inbound Eisenhower. That is heading east right before Central Avenue. Expect delays up to 20 minutes over there. Other than that, it's mostly business as usual. Eisenhower's looking a bit heavier on the outbound. It's going to take you about 30 minutes if you're heading from downtown to Montrose, but that is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Do we have Russell? Russell, are you with us? Or is he stuck?
With you. I think Dr. Ademiak might be joining us, too.
Well, that'd be cool. That was Dr. Ademiak, are you with us? I don't hear her.
Not yet, but right. She's coming.
I mean,
there she is.
We still need to talk to her about the Vietnam experience in lieu of our Veterans Week. Dr. Ademiak, how are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'll tell you what. I mean, I'm always excited about doing the show, especially when I get people like you and Russell on and so forth. This week, I'm more excited than ever, really, because we've been doing this veterans thing and trying to, go step by step.
I stayed once right on the other side.
We did the lady who works with the veterans, and then Kenny just was part of a group that just raised a bunch of money for Headstrong is the name of the organization that does mental work for veterans. And then we had a psychologist, my friend from, like, longtime friend from college, Dr. Johnson, on this morning. He's done a lot of work with veterans, and the veterans home where he is up in New Hampshire is the one that has pioneered a lot of the mental health stuff for PTSD and all that stuff. So we're trying to put a whole collage together of this. And I know you and I wanted to talk about the Vietnam experience someday. We won't do it today, but when people came back, and on Friday we're having somebody on who was overseas in Germany for a long time and talk about the veterans care over there, and trying to put it all together and give somewhat of a picture, maybe, I don't know about a solution, but interesting stuff. I mean, it really is. And by the way, you were one of the people that got me onto this when you said we should talk about Vietnam someday. So you're either to blame or the person that I can say put me onto this. So thank you.
Well, I just feel like this is a generation of people that were thrust into something that was unprecedented, and I don't know that was handled very well.
It wasn't. I'll help you. It wasn't.
Well, I mean, but when everybody came back from war, I think that a lot of those individuals were really left on their own with no support system. And people really didn't think about how to really integrate them back into society, how to give them the mental health support that they needed. And it was a, I think, a very, very difficult time for these. And they're very young men. Yep. Right? We're not talking about 40 or 50 year old men who have developed fully cognitively, right? We're talking about 18 year old kids coming back from war who have witnessed horrific things. And as our society, we did nothing for them.
Did very little. I mean, if you get a chance, listen to the first hour, because Dr. Johnson went through a lot of this stuff. And he said every war is the same but different. Everyone has kind of different experiences and something. You know what he brought up, though, Larissa, is something about people have real moral issues. What am I doing here? Why did I just shoot that guy? What's the point? I never heard of that before. I mean, I assume that people don't like killing people, but because there's real moral issues that everything you've been taught your whole life, you just did the exact opposite. And he says there's a lot of that. There's people being wounded around you. There's you being wounded. He goes, there's a whole, and Dr. Johnson's obviously done a lot of work on this stuff, because evidently the lead guy in this whole thing was a guy who was an internist and then went back and became a board certified psychologist, and he worked with the veterans people, and he knew all about it. And the veterans home, I think he said it was in Hanover, somewhere up in New Hampshire, Vermont, was the lead sword in this whole mess. So he knows a lot about it. I was surprised about all the different stuff. And so, yeah, every war is sort of different. The just the different stuff people were involved in. You know, and you talked about, you mentioned the burning pits and stuff. He goes, if you start throwing cancer and all kinds of stuff on top of it, it all just gets worse. But it was pretty fascinating.
Well, one of my buddies fought in the Gulf War, and he told me this horrific story that I'm going to tell you. And so this kid, I think when he had gone, he was 18 or 19, maybe 20, but I think 18 or 19, and they would fly in the helicopters and just shoot randomly. And he said, you know, that didn't faze him much, because the probability of actually hitting anything was very low. But one day his helicopter, something had happened and he had to bail on the helicopter. So he jumps out of the helicopter while it's flying. He lands in the desert. He's a kid. He needs to use the restroom. Okay. And so if you're, again, this is why being a kid is being a kid, right? And he's like, well, I'm in the desert. I'm alone, but I'm still going to find a set of rocks so I can have a little privacy.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like...
you never know if a Gila monster's watching you or a snake.
Exactly. So he finds a pile of rocks, and he sees a soldier, who we're fighting, and the guy's gun is outside of arm's reach. And the gentleman there was doing what he was going to do, and, he, you know, squatting, taking care of business. And my buddy said before he had a moment to think, he had his gun out and shot him. And he was devastated by this. And because, you know, we're Americans, he had to make a joke. And he said, well, I no longer had to use the restroom.
But yeah.
The fact that he was telling me this 15 years after it happened demonstrates how deeply it impacted this poor young man. And he's going to carry that with him for the rest of his life. And he did note that the other soldier was going for his gun. So it most likely would have been him. Somebody was going to die.
Well, on one level, it's justified. On another level, why did I have to shoot this guy? What am I doing over here?
Right, exactly. Why are we fighting? We're both two young guys looking to use the restroom in the middle of the desert. This is what we're fighting over, for a little space and rocks for privacy. It's just horrifying. And again, to your point, it is justifiable, because it would have been him versus this other guy, and it's in self-defense. You can make that argument. But to your point of, why am I even here? Why am I doing this? And we've also commented on the military training that had him so well trained that he didn't think about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, what you just mentioned is very similar God, I can't believe I remember this stuff. I don't know if you ever watched NCIS. I used to, but there was a scene where Gibbs's father was still alive. A lot of everybody on the show died. They're all up there, but evidently he was a fighter pilot or something during the war, and he had a bunch of air bomber or something. Well, it turns out he has a store, and somebody came in the store. Some guy was all hopped up on whatever, started to rob some girl, and he was going to hurt the lady. So he had a gun behind the counter, and he shot the guy. And it was all, you know, justified and all that kind of stuff. Well, he comes to talk to the son, and the father was all bent out of shape. And the son says, I looked into it. You did everything right. And he says, you've killed people before in the war. He goes, I never saw the person I killed before. It's the first time I actually saw somebody I killed. It's a big difference. And I'm saying, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
And Larissa, the other day, I forgot where we were driving, but I think we were talking about this, and we were talking about how, you know, it's so much drone and so mechanized, you really don't see who you're killing in these days. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it's gotten even more video game-ish. How's that for a...
Well, here's a little personal aside. I have some friends that I meet a couple times a week, and they're attorneys. Well, last week, I was regaled by one of the murder cases, and the guy's showing me all the films of people getting shot outside of this nightclub.
Oh, goodness.
And I'm sitting there, well, that's cool. I mean, you know, people are hurling bullets. One guy, the guy was down on the ground, and the guy shot him from 40 yards away to make sure he was dead. And, well, then, that's last week. Yesterday morning, I come to work, and the guy works in the building, Hispanic, a good friend of mine. He's from this town in Mexico. I don't know if you guys heard about the mayor down there who got assassinated. That's his town. So yesterday morning, while I'm cooking breakfast, he's showing me video of the guy getting shot in front of all these people, in front of his family, and I'm sitting there going, what the hell? What is the... I asked Dr. Johnson, what is the stress of the people standing there watching a guy you like get shot? And he had, of course, a name for it. He goes, yeah, that's a big deal. Those people might be 20 years from now still having a problem with that, especially the kids. I mean, it's all over. I mean, I'm sitting there a lot. This kid just walked up and shot the guy because he was very anti-gang. And now and everybody loved the guy. He had something like 100,000 people are going to show up at his funeral or something. I mean, it's unreal. But here's a video of somebody walking up and blasting a dude. I mean, I'm happy I didn't. I had a high number, or I was a little too old or too young. I didn't have to go. I guess I'm that's the bottom line, I suppose. But anyway, hey, so we'll talk a little bit more about that next week when we fill all this stuff up, but I encourage you to listen to what Mark was saying earlier, because he said it way better than I could paraphrase what he said, let's put it that way. What'd you make of yesterday's sell-off? And what's your feel on this? Well, I don't know why I keep having this hair in the back of my neck going up, that this cryptocurrency stuff is big enough in a lot of areas of the world to where if it were to have crack out somehow, there's going to be real pockets of problems. And I can't figure out how much is short interest. I can't figure out how much the margin debt is on it. And it makes me very nervous. Now, I don't think Russell thinks I should be so nervous about it, but I am.
I don't think you should be so nervous about it because it's, you know, everybody's an adult and everybody's responsible for themselves. And if you're doing dumb stuff, you know, shame on you. You brought up people taking out second mortgages to buy crypto. You know, if somebody does that, at some point there is some personal responsibility here with respect to all of this.
Well, I get it. I'm just saying, I mean, sometimes though, when people do stupid stuff, like in the mortgage crisis, it affected everybody.
Yeah.
So yep. I guess a better question might be, how many people are doing these stupid things, and what is the overall like percentage of their assets? So, for example, in the mortgage industry crisis, you're looking at people who were totally overlevered, and a substantial number of people who were doing this. So, for example, if you're somebody who has two or three homes and you can't really afford the mortgage on any of them, then we have a problem. But if we have a situation where it's a small percentage of people doing stupid things with crypto, then it's not necessarily as big of an issue.
Well, Larissa, here's my view on the thing. And again, it's for whatever reason, I don't know if Russell made me do this. I went back and did a lot of research on the tulip crisis. back in Holland, you know, 400 years ago, the 300 years, whatever it was. And I started reading about it, and there's a couple guys I know in the local bar that got a bunch of money that bought five cryptos at bitcoins at $10,000 cash, and it went up to 120, and now it's 100. I don't worry about that at all. I mean, if the guy gets back and he gets his 10 grand back, you know, unless he used that money to go do something else, I agree with you. It's no skin off anybody's behind. But you looked at the tulip situation, it's eerily the same as today. As long as people just bought tulips with cash, it goes up, it goes down, okay, no harm, no foul. But somewhere along the line, it was put on the exchanges of the day. And then a little later, they became marginable. And people could borrow money to buy the tulips. And that's when everything crashed, and that's when the big problem occurred, because people had borrowed money, margin money in there. And that's my concern is with the crypto, is the same way. Somehow or another, people are borrowing to buy this stuff, and I can't put my hands around it. That's got me worried.
I was just going to say, the exchanges of the day, you know, it was taverns, right? They were doing all this in bars.
Okay.
Well, and I'd also like
so to... So it's heavily... I'm sorry, Lewis. I know I always talk over you, but they weren't regulated. You know, when you said... I wanted to clarify that if, you know, when you said the exchanges of the day, it wasn't like there was any... It was basically people placing bets in bars. That's the extent.
Well, I was more concerned about the margin. Once you can borrow, then you got a problem.
Well, yeah, and then that's the bartender letting you borrow. So, sorry, Lewis, go ahead.
So, and the other thing, I mean, I want to make the analogy or parallel between the 2008 crisis. So going into 2008, people had disposable income to start doing some of these things. I don't know that a lot of people today have that comfort of that disposable income to start getting into these securities. And again, that's why I'd be curious of who's buying these, how much they're buying, what percentage of their portfolio are they over levering themselves. So again, you know, if we're looking at 50% of the population who's struggling to buy eggs, they're not participating. And in 2008, that wasn't the case. So we had a majority of the American people participating in this incredible bubble of housing. And I don't know that, and I don't see it happening right now with these types of currencies.
Larissa, why, and when we think back at the 2008 stuff, you know, and let's be very blunt, you guys are the top of the food chain when it comes to knowledge about this stuff. Why does everybody, the collective memory seems to be, you know, and I met one lady, very attractive, as I recall, a stewardess that had, flight attendant now, that had two or three houses. And everybody remembers that. And it's a problem. Okay, I get that part. But everybody seems to have forgotten there were $35 of leverage on every house. And that, for every dollar in mortgage, there was $35 of leverage on top of it, where people were borrowing money from Japan at, you know, 1% or 1.5%, and popping them into mortgages. I mean, it doesn't seem to be collective memory that was the problem, not the individual person that had a house they couldn't afford. The collapse came from the leverage, not from the person. And I don't know, I guess I'm curious as to why people...
The leverage was employed by those individual people.
No, I'm talking about on top of that. There were 35 out...
I see what you're saying, the security. Yeah.
The
derivative securities on top of the mortgages themselves.
Remember the Goldman mm-hmm. Sachs... portfolio of mortgages that was the poster child, the 100 they sold in Europe or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was all synthetic mortgages. There weren't enough mortgages.
Yeah, and they bought insurance on them as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So I sold them to other people, and then they bought insurance on them because they. I worked at a firm where they tried to get us to become insurance sellers on those things.
Wow.
Where Goldman did, yeah. So. Yeah, and one smart guy at the firm that I worked at said, you know, if it's such a great business, why don't they just do it? Why are they trying to get us to do it?
Right.
Well, why didn't the Fed or somebody who has access to it, and I don't think you guys got access to a whole bunch of stuff at Purdue and IU, I don't think you would have access to the amount of money being borrowed in Japan and sent over here and buying mortgages. The Fed had to be the only people that had access to that. And why didn't they do something?
I don't even know if the Fed would have access to that. I'm not in a position. If I were at my desk, I would, you know, maybe pull up a couple of mortgage back, because there are mortgage bonds out there now, and see if it's possible to see who the holders are of them. But you know, it's like everybody was holding them back. That was the problem. The real problem. I worked at a very dull firm in Kansas for a year, and we don't talk about that in my household because we barely survived it. One of our dogs didn't even make it out of Kansas. It was so horrible. But there was this one person that was running around bragging about how they were able to get 50 extra basis points with a AAA credit over and over again. And all I know is that firm ended up being bought out by a much larger firm shortly after the financial crisis. I never did any digging, but I will almost guarantee you that that them going for that extra half a basis point, and this was an insurance company, but them going after that extra 50 basis points, et cetera, for what was supposed to be AAA paper, it's a big insurance company ends up being bought out by Guggenheim because they had, they had exposure to things they probably didn't fully understand, or somebody was getting a better bonus because they were getting better, better AAA yield, even though they were taking on risk that they shouldn't have been taking on. I'm sitting here picking. We're sitting here picking on the individuals that were talked into interest-only loans, which apparently are becoming a thing again now.
To make 3%
more affordable.
3% down everywhere. You get 3% down.
No, where the kind of terms that people had back in 2008 are coming back around. In fact, when I'm getting ready to, I might bother my realtor a bit about this. When we start looking at the houses this morning,
Larissa, I got a crazy little story for you. Shows you what a dummy I am in terms of not seeing a crisis. I went out to see, did a house call. I met a potential client at Panera Bread, way the hell, Northwest suburbs. The guy brings his wife, right? And let's just say the wife is unusually attractive. I mean, we're talking movie star material. Not that I remember. And I said, well, what do you do for a living? She goes, well, I just got laid off. And I'm thinking, okay, wait a minute. Who the hell would lay her off? Being the male, I still am. And turns out she worked for a mortgage firm that had just gone out of business. This is right before all this happened. I said, well, why'd you go out of business? Well, all of a sudden the business dried up. But get a load of this. She said, we were putting together packages of mortgages, charging people whatever we charge and the surveys and all the other kind of crap. And she goes, people were coming and buying the mortgage from us for 6% over the principal price. I said, wait, get this straight. You guys put together $3 million worth of mortgages, and somebody was coming in and buying it from you at $3,180,000. And she goes, yeah. And why had a light bulb didn't go off in my head and saying, this? I almost didn't believe it. It wasn't like I was going to go out there and short mortgages if I could have, but that's how crazy it was. I mean, it just had nothing to do with the poor person in the house. Can you even imagine that?
So, if you got certainty that you're going to get the cash flows and you discount them back at a different interest rate than people are paying, I can sort of believe it. But I would do a lot of due diligence before paying $3,180,000 for $3 million.
You would think.
I mean, that, you've got to, and I don't know. There's always this assumption that people are doing all this due diligence. Maybe they're not.
Oh, if people are making money, you're just throwing it at it. Larissa, how do you what classes are you teaching? Tell us a little bit.
I have a comment though about that. Yeah. And remember, we're saying this with almost 20 years in hindsight, right?
Yeah.
At the time when all of this was happening, we lived under this idea that mortgages didn't default.
Oh yeah.
So we calculated the default rate for a mortgage of less than 0.5%. So from we're talking about this, I don't want people to think that at the time that people were just being incredibly greedy. It got incredibly greedy, but at the time we were living under false assumptions.
Well, what
and
would
we
you
didn't want to question those assumptions?
What would you
we
guess the
assumptions?
What would you guess the default rate on U.S. mortgages was between 1947 and 2007? I'll bet it's like next to nothing, isn't it?
Oh, it was. And so I worked for a company called Derivative Solutions, which was owned by FactSet, and we modeled mortgage-backed securities. And we assumed that the default rate for our pricing for these bonds was less than 0.5%. It was like next to nothing. You're not really thinking about these mortgages defaulting. So we had a very poor underlying assumption that was incorrect. And it could have been correct historically, but because things had changed, we've, you know, relaxed some of the rules, particularly around how much money you need to have down, the different types and structure of the loan to the individual. Mm-hmm. I know you keep wanting to jump to the derivative part, but it still originates with the individual to be able to generate enough mortgages to incorporate into that entire security for that mortgage-backed security. You have to sell more mortgages.
What would have happened if there was a, I lost it, Lewis, unfortunately, but somebody wrote in 2007, a 2 or 3 page article somewhere, recharted the price at the time, which you know better than me, was probably, what, 235 was the median house, right? And he said, if somebody gave you the down payment, you needed $85,000 a year to afford that house. This is before the insurance went up and the taxes. And the guy said that only 15% of the population made more than $85,000 a year. When I read that article, I'm going, I mean, if you guys were in that company, if you would have read that article, would it have made any difference to your point of view?
For modeling?
Yeah, just because they'd gotten so ahead of the ability of the average person to play. And by the way, it's way worse now. The 406 on the house, you probably need 150 to carry the place, and I don't think 15% of the population makes $150,000.
Sure. No, it's there's a large disparity between houses and actual income, and it happens in I would make the argument that a lot more neighborhoods than we would think. So even some of the more wealthy neighborhoods where you have houses that are definitely well above 230, maybe pushing $2 or $3 million per house in that neighborhood, you have to think, how much does somebody really need to be able to, again, as you put it, carry the mortgage, even with a hefty down payment?
Well, you cheat a little bit by having two people working.
Sure.
But then that leads to all kinds of other expenses, child care and all the other stuff. So, I mean, it's not, the second salary is never free, is it? It's usually part of that goes for a lot of other stuff. You need a second car, you need all kinds of stuff, right?
Well, and the rule of thumb is that the second person needs to be making at least $60,000, essentially to break even.
Yeah.
Well, because of child care.
I would agree with that. Anyway, guys, we got a dash, but hey, Russell, don't be a stranger. I love it when you're on. And obviously, Russell's always the best. And this has been probably the most fun week I've had doing the show in ages. So thank to all you guys. And we still have to talk more about the Vietnam stuff. I'd love to, you know what, I might, the next time Dr. Johnson comes on, maybe you can pile in and talk to him about it. Because he was very, obviously that was our era. And he said there was a rejection at home that was a big problem that you didn't get in other wars. That's why he said all of them are kind of different.
Yeah.
I mean, he said, that's an issue. You did all this stuff and you came back and people didn't even like you. That's a problem. Anyway, I hope you're right about this crypto stuff, Russell. I don't want to see the market going down here. I actually like my clients to make money and not lose it.
Oh, yeah.
It's a much better deal. All right, guys, take care of yourself. Have a good week. Good luck on that book. Next week, let's talk a little more about the book, eh? SP futures unchanged, NASDAQ futures down 7. We'll see what today brings and talk about it tomorrow morning.
That's all, folks.